Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. Did you know you could get CDs from us and listen to a year's worth of Real Science Friday shows on one CD? It is so much fun. In fact, I'm holding in my hand the Real Science Friday 2011 CD. It's an MP3 CD. You can get the MP3 CD, play it in an MP3 player, or even play it in a DVD player or your computer. So you can get it for 2011, 2010, all the way back to 2006. If you'd like, hundreds of Real Science Friday shows convenient on a single MP3 CD, and it'll support the airing of Real Science Friday. So just call us at 1-800-8-ENYART, 1-800-836-9278, or go online, realsciencefriday.com, and click on the store. And, of course, that'll help us continue to broadcast. May God bless you. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. It's not every day you get to talk to an astronomer. Well, in studio, we have Dr. Danny Faulkner with the Creation Research Society. Welcome, Dr. Faulkner.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about the sun and the earth? If we're billions of years old, seems like that introduces all kinds of problems that evolutionists don't always acknowledge.
That's right, Bob. We have what's called the earlier young faint sun paradox. It's a problem that astronomers have known about for decades. In the last 15 years, they've offered at least three different solutions to this problem, but I don't think they have it right yet.
Oh, so if a different solution is offered every 5 years, like where did the moon come from? Every so often, there's another theory and they say, oops, that didn't work. So that's an indication that they really don't have an answer. Well, what is the problem then?
We have a pretty good understanding, we think, of how the sun works. We think it's being powered by nuclear reactions deep down in the core of the sun, where every second a huge amount of hydrogen is fused into helium to produce that energy. And that theory is correct, then the sun could be powered for about 10 billion years.
Because of all the fuel, because of how enormous it is, it's like a million Earths or something.
Right, and the nuclear energy is extremely efficient, as it turns out. And that's been a theory we've had for most of the 20th, now in the 21st century. And we have some evidence that that works with solar neutrino experiments.
For a while, they couldn't find the neutrinos, right?
Yeah, they solved that problem back in 2001. They found out that the neutrinos actually oscillate between the three types, and now we've got good agreement. But we have good evidence now that the sun is getting most of its energy from the fusion of hydrogen to helium. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is that over billions of years, you're going to change the composition of the core. As you change from hydrogen to helium, it changes the mean molecular weight of the core tremendously. And as you do that, it raises the temperature and the pressure inside the core.
Oh.
And those nuclear reactions are extremely sensitive to temperature. And so everybody recognized that over billions of years, the sun's rate of energy production ought to increase, so much to the point that the sun should be about 40% brighter now than it was when it first formed, supposedly 4.5 billion years ago.
That's why you called it the faint young sun paradox.
Yep.
Faint. In other words, it'd be brighter now than it was 4.5 billion years ago.
And even more importantly, 3.5 billion years ago, it would have brightened up some. But today, it should be about 25% brighter than it was 3.5 billion years ago, supposedly when life first formed on the Earth.
So if we had a fainter sun, the sun was not putting off as much light and as much heat, as much energy.
The Earth should have been very cold back then.
Cold Earth.
The cold Earth effect, don't tell Al Gore about this. He'd have a heart attack. But you can run the numbers. I've run the numbers myself just to check it out.
You're in the video that I saw recently that is just stunning, a great DVD called The Young Sun.
Mm-hmm.
You're in there with Dr. Jason Lyle.
And Dr. Ron Samick.
That's right.
And anyway,
so you ran the numbers.
Ran the numbers, and I found out, and the numbers I agree with everybody else gets, the sun, the Earth should have brightened up by about 17 Celsius. temperature. And the average temperature of the Earth today is around 15 Celsius. That's the average, the overall, the entire globe. So if you subtract 17 from 15, you get minus 2, which in real temperature is about
freezing.
Is about 28 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you should have had an ice planet like on the second Star Wars movie.
Everything is frozen. So if there was water on the surface of the Earth, it'd all be frozen. It would have been frozen for millions or billions of years.
Well, once you get it frozen, it's very difficult to get it out of that because the light is reflected rather than absorbed off the ice and snow.
Wow.
So we should still be a snowbound Earth. And furthermore, no geologist or biologist thinks the Earth was ever like that. So they have to come up with an explanation of how the Earth was much warmer in the past or absorbing more energy from the sun and holding on to it. And then as the sun got brighter, that somehow got less efficient in absorbing the energy from the sun. So it seems to me that it would rule out the solar system, the sun and the Earth, being billions of years old. Of course, over thousands of years, as I happen to believe the world is, that's not a problem.
Wow. So that is one argument. What's fun about creationists is they have many arguments. And the arguments are so powerful and they're broad observations about the way physics work and the way the solar system works and the way the galaxies work. So this problem about the young sun, you said that's been known for a long time.
Yes.
Would Carl Sagan have known about
it? Oh, sure. This has been around probably before the 60s, I'm going to guess. It was first written up in the 60s that I'm aware of.
Okay.
There was an article in Science Magazine around 65 or 67. And by the way, how many Carl Sagans does it take to change the light bulb?
I don't know.
Billions and billions.
That's good, Danny Faulkner. Now, he's died, right?
No, I haven't. I'm still alive. But,
no,
but Carl Sagan died about 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. So, and the sad thing is, I don't think he wanted to be with the Lord when he died.
No, he was an agnostic. Larry Vardaman from ICR actually built a relationship with him the last few years of his life. And Larry sent him a series of letters back and forth. And Larry witnessed to him in those letters. And actually, it turns out Carl Sagan was a genuine person, apparently, and had a very good relationship with Larry, even though they disagreed about a tremendous amount of things.
Yeah, wow. How about how stars form? You have a PhD in astronomy. You're an astronomer. When I read in the popular press, they make it sound like the Big Bang cosmologists, they have it all figured out. They know exactly how stars form. And from what I know, that's being oversold. They don't really have it all figured out.
No, the mechanism really wasn't understood. They believe that the gas clouds, which are made of primarily hydrogen and helium, somehow collapse to form stars over some process that's yet not quite understood. Mm-hmm. There is a point, if you get a gas cloud down to a small enough size, gravity can take over and shrink it on down. We call this the Kelvin-Helmholtz mechanism, which actually does work. The problem is you have to get the gas cloud down to that size, and real gas clouds are many orders of magnitude larger than that minimum size, called the Jeans length after an astronomer almost 100 years ago who first calculated this maximum size a gas cloud can have in order to collapse.
So gravity has to overcome temperature and pressure because gas would dissipate.
Yeah, what happens is the gas clouds have pressure and temperature, and if you collapsed it down a little bit, gravity might increase a slight amount, but pressure would increase more and would re-expand. We say it's stable against collapse, and it's very well understood physics. What you have to do is jumpstart it. You have to get it crammed down to a small size.
It's sort of like the evolution of life.
Yeah.
They say, where did life come from? Well, you have to start with life.
Yeah.
And then you get life. Darwin's Origin of the Species, he sort of overreached when he picked that title because he doesn't describe the origin of species. He starts with species.
And you're absolutely right there, because what's interesting is all the mechanisms that have been put forth of how you can collapse a gas cloud down, all of them suppose that stars first exist.
They already existed.
Yeah, have to have at least one generation of stars. Many have many generations of stars prior. And so it doesn't explain how stars ultimately formed at the beginning.
So when you're reading about how a star would form in a secular worldview, you have a gas cloud, and maybe one example is there's a nearby star that explodes, and the explosion forces the gas cloud to condense.
Yeah.
Well, you say, well, wait a minute, you're cheating. You're starting with a star that's exploding.
Where did that star come from?
Right.
Chicken and egg sort of question.
Yeah.
And all the textbooks, the graduate level textbooks on stellar structure back as far as the 1960s, were pointing out this is a problem, but they were confident they would soon solve it. And I've looked at textbooks published in the last 5 years that say the same thing. It's a thorny problem, but we'll eventually solve
it. We'll solve it soon.
And what's related to that, interestingly enough, is that they believe in the early universe. There was what they call starbursts. They have galaxies way, way far off. They call starburst galaxies, where they claim that early in the universe, right after the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, there were all these stars forming at a prodigious rate, and that's not the rate even claimed today. And you ask, well, what was the mechanism? Well, they say basically there's a huge amount of star formation early on from some unknown mechanism.
Mm.
Well, that's not science, but
right.
It gets talked about as if it is.
It's a story, though.
Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of stars form early on. How about when we look at galaxies that appear to be much further away than nearby galaxies? Shouldn't they then appear like they are just in their infancy compared to mature ones nearby?
That's a very good point. As you go farther out at greater and greater distances, you're presumably looking what we call look-back time. We have galaxies, you know, 6, 8, 10 billion light years away from us. And you want to look at the structure of those galaxies. And when you look at the structures, they look just like local galaxies,
right,
the same age. And,
yeah,
and there's no evolution, as you can see. And you look at the metal abundance that they have. In the early universe, you're supposed to have just hydrogen and helium and nothing else. The heavier elements such as the calcium in our bones and the iron in our blood, all of those were forged in
they say supernovas, stars blew up, formed all these heavier elements.
And they say we're made out of stardust.
So, yes, yeah, right. Maybe there was a little lithium early on, did they say?
Yeah, a little bit of lithium, not much.
Okay, so all the heavier elements that are in the planets in our solar system, where did they come from? They say they came from stars that blew up.
But when you look at very distant galaxies, and even look at even more distant object, quasars, mm-hmm, perhaps before there were galaxies, you find the same elements we have today. So where did these elements come from?
So it doesn't make sense. The Hubble Deep Field images, where, if I understand, in fact, we're in a building right now where a Christian school was housed for 30 years, Maranatha Christian Center, and one of the science teachers was a project lead for the Hubble telescope here in Boulder, Colorado, and he's a Christian. Praise God. Well, the Hubble Deep Field image, as I understand it, they would focus on a little pinpoint of space for a long time and let the light come in, the photons, and they would show that there are thousands of galaxies in the littlest speck of space.
Yeah, that was taken, I think, in 1996. It was like 100 hours or so of exposures. And if you took a large grain of sand and held it out at arm's length, it would just barely cover that patch in the sky. I think there were 1,700 galaxies identified.
And, Danny, I made a prediction. I've been on the air since 1991. So here I am, a fundamentalist Bible preacher, talk show host, making a prediction against NASA. NASA said that we're going to see the evidence of the most distant galaxies, that they're in their infancy, that they were just evolving. And I said, no, they're not. They're going to look just like all the other galaxies. Now, I didn't know that. God could make however he wants to make galaxies, but their evolutionary assumptions, I presume, would not be corroborated. And sure enough, there's not evidence that when we look at the furthest galaxies, they look like infant galaxies.
That's right. As far as I can tell, the only difference between very distant galaxies and local galaxies is that there is a slight systematic color difference, or slightly more blue than nearby galaxies.
Mm.
And that's interpreted as evidence of starburst, but that's just an interpretation of that,
mm-hmm,
nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only significant difference I'm aware of.
So you're an astronomer, you've got a PhD. Could we talk about who you are? You're with the Creation Research Society, but that's like your night job.
Yeah.
What's your day job?
Day job. For the past 26 years, I've been on the faculty of the Lancaster campus of the University of South Carolina. Mm. That is a state university campus.
But wait a minute. You're a young earth creationist. You believe God made us and the universe in the recent past, just thousands, not billions of years ago. How could you be there? You're not supposed to be there.
I know. The Expelled movie has all these horror stories.
Ben Stein's. Yeah.
And there are a few examples of the other way it's like me.
Huh.
And the short answer is that I'm so proud of my university and my state. Academic freedom is alive and well at the University of South Carolina.
Wow, that is great. There have been, I'm sure, over the years, times when atheists would want to get you fired, cause trouble for you. What happens when that happens?
Well, I know of in the last 2 years, we have had people contact the university, starting with my campus and working all the way up to the president's office because they didn't get anywhere on my local campus. One from Canada, the other one from someplace in the United States. I don't even know where. And tried to get me in trouble, tried to get me reined in, and it didn't work. They simply told them, Dr. Faulkner is a well-respected professor, has a PhD from a good institution, and we're proud of his work, and it's his academic freedom, and he can do what he wants to on that.
In fact, you have a book out, Universe by Design, and I think you guys had a book signing right there on campus.
Oh, yes. I think the book came out in 2005, I believe. And when I got my first copies, I went to my campus dean. He's not a creationist, by the way, but he's a good man, and he likes good arguments because he's a philosopher. And he looked at it, and the first words out of his mouth were exactly what I expected. He said, let's do a book signing. So the campus bookstore ordered a couple of cases of the books. We sent out advertisements, letters to supporters of the campus, and I was able to add to the list. We had a very well-attended, best-attended probably of any of our book signings.
Wow.
And sold out of the books and had to order some more. I understand one person in the community, I don't know who it was, but he called and was complaining, wanted to know, how could you do a book signing for something like that? And my campus dean said, he wrote a book. I published a book. I wished all of my faculty would. And you know, that night when he introduced me, I think it was the best introduction I have gotten in my entire life.
Isn't that just awesome?
It is. It's great. I love my campus.
So academic freedom is reality. America, we do have Judeo-Christian roots, and there's tremendous freedom to believe what you want to believe, to publish, free speech, freedom of religion. In much of the world where, for example, Islam is in control, like in Saudi Arabia, there are no synagogues in Mecca or Medina. There's not a single church in the entire country of Saudi Arabia. So freedom does come along with the Judeo-Christian worldview.
Yes, absolutely.
So could we talk about when you said that star formation, they don't have it nailed down, the atheists and the Big Bang cosmologists. Which came first in their model, stars or galaxies? I have a quote here from John Maddox, who was the editor of the journal Nature for 23 years. And he says, which came first? This is in his book, What Remains to Be Discovered. He said, which objects came first, stars or galaxies? Theoretical science offers no clear guidance. Danny, if they don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, stars or galaxies, that's an admission that there's way too much confidence put in the Big Bang. They don't know. They're guessing at all kinds of stuff.
When I was in grad school in the 80s, early 80s, mid-80s, it was taught to us that the galaxies came first, then stars came along. And that had been the theory for a long time, but in the last 25 years, it's reversed. Now the dominant idea seems to be, and that's not my field of expertise, but I do read up on it, seems to be that stars formed first, then galaxies kind of formed up. So it's top down or bottom up.
Yeah.
So they've completely flipped, and I think another, you know, 30 years, they might flip back again. Who knows?
Right. It's like explaining where the moon came from. The reason there are multiple theories is because none of the theories answer the problems.
Yeah, you know, back in the 60s with the Apollo program, the real reason we went to the moon was to beat the Russians, all right? But, of course, we had to dress that up a little bit, and we dressed up. We're going to find out which of the three models, the theories of where the moon came from, will be proven or disproven by what we find. And, of course, the data from the Apollo program proved that all three of them was wrong.
Right.
So we're wrong. So the one WAG suggested that the best conclusion was that the moon didn't exist.
It's an observational error, right? It doesn't exist. That's what the atheists are saying about information science.
Right.
They're saying information doesn't exist because they can't explain it. This is fun.
Yes.
Atheism leads toward ignorance.
It does.
The Bible says the fool says there is no God. So with the moon, if atheists, secular cosmologists, if they can't really figure out how the moon formed, that's really close to us.
Yeah.
They can't explain how a star formed. They don't know what came first, stars or galaxies. They're just way overselling the whole story.
I do believe. I agree with that. The thing is, they come up with a theory that seems to be absolutely positively true, and then 10 years later, they've got something that's totally different, and they forget about what they said before.
How about the moon being about 400 times closer than the sun is, and it's about 400 times smaller in diameter than the sun is, so we can have this beautiful solar eclipse where we can see the corona of the sun, and it really has opened up astronomy for us. That perfect ratio, there's no other moon in our solar system with scores of moons that would give a perfect eclipse to its planet, just ours. Isn't that alone? And the moon's pull on the oceans to keep them oxygenated with the tides and all. Isn't that in and of itself evidence of design?
I think so. I think if you look around, you can see design all sorts of places. And the moon is a fascinating thing. You know, its orbit is unique. It orbits most large satellites in the solar system orbit above the equator of their parent planets. Mm. The moon is alone in the fact that it orbits close to the orbit of our orbit around the sun, tilted about 23.5 degrees to the equator. And it turns out that has certain design aspects of stabilizing the Earth's tilt and some other things going on. Either it's designed or it's just coincidence. And that's unfortunately what's going to happen. If you don't believe in design, then you're going to deny it because you don't see it.
Right.
You're not going to see it.
And the moon has a very close to circular orbit around the Earth. Isn't that true?
Yes.
And the Earth has a relatively circular orbit around the sun. If it was oblong, like other planets and exoplanets around other stars, we'd be frying and then freezing.
Yeah, Mars is a good example. It has a very elliptical orbit, and one hemisphere melts off all of its carbon dioxide ice, dry ice, in its summer because it's too warm, but the other one doesn't. And so it's not exactly circular, but very close. It's interesting, in the northern hemisphere, we're closer to the sun in our winter and farther away in our summer.
Oh.
And what that does, you'd think it would cause our winters to be warmer and cooler. Mm-hmm. Indeed, they do. But the other hemisphere is a reverse. And so you think they'd have very hot summers and very cooler winters.
Yeah.
When you look at the southern hemisphere, it's like 90% water. And the heat capacity of water is very high, the highest substance that I'm aware of, and which means it acts as a thermal buffer. And it takes a while to warm it up in the summer, so it keeps the land cooler than it would be. And it takes a while to cool it off in the winter, which keeps the land warm in the winter, and you get a wash. It's pretty much the same seasonal differences we find in the northern hemisphere. And again, what's the chance of that? Best odds, 1 in 4. But how many coincidences like this can you have?
Mm. Some of the arguments we've made on the air, Fred Williams and I, he's the webmaster for Creation Research Society.
He sure is.
He's a software engineer and a great co-host. We make arguments. We're not astronomers, so correct me if we're wrong, and we'll correct it on the air and on our website. But the spiral arms of the spiral galaxies, physics indicate that they would be deformed after millions of years. They shouldn't retain their beautiful spiral shapes.
That's correct. This is a problem that was identified probably in the 1930s when they really realized that galaxies existed outside of our own. And it was not until the late 60s that they finally came up with a solution for this, what they call spiral density wave theory, that this idea is a sound wave propagating through the interstellar medium inside the galaxy. It's a sound wave, basically, modifying with a gravitational pull. And everybody said, well, that's it. For the next 30
years. If that was solid, they wouldn't come up with dark matter, I imagine.
Well what happened? But for 30 years, that was kind of accepted to be true. But there was a small group of people that, you know, continued to work on it, and they realized they had problems with it. So by the 1990s, they were appealing to satellite galaxies, little satellites or galaxies going around perturbing the
like
galaxies.
Like Shepard galaxies?
Something like that. And now, of course, the latest dope in the last 10 or 15 years has been dark matter, which there's evidence that it might exist apart from this, but dark matter is actually responsible for all of this. So they've gone through, in my lifetime, 3 different explanations once again. And if any one of them worked, then you wouldn't need the other two. Mm. So I think each new one is a tacit admission that the last one really didn't work. Mm. I'm not convinced. I think of the three, I'm probably least convinced of dark matter. For one thing, I think it happens to be somewhat spherically symmetrical around the center of the galaxy, in which case it's not going to do anything like that for you.
Mm. How about the missing shadow? NASA has, of course, terabytes upon terabytes of data. And so some scientists have looked at their data from 31 nearby galaxies, and they said, you know, we're going to be able to find the shadow of the Big Bang. We know the Big Bang happened 13.5 billion. Is that how old it is?
13.71 billion and 5 years ago.
And 5 years ago.
Because they announced it 5 years ago. I have to keep updating.
Okay, right. And I know when I was going to school, every few grades, the universe got a billion years older. So now it's 13.
You're really old, aren't you?
Yeah. So it's about 13.5 billion years old. Okay. So if the Big Bang really happened, and then we see the microwave background radiation called the CMB, cosmic microwave background, whatever, then the nearby galaxies should sort of shadow that explosion from us. They went looking for the shadow of the Big Bang.
Back in 65, they discovered the background radiation. It was heralded as being the great proof, and as far as I'm concerned, the only single prediction that the Big Bang model has made. And you would expect it to come from the farthest corners of the universe. So you would expect this shadow effect that's mentioned there. And by not finding it, it strongly suggests that the background radiation isn't very distant at all. It's not cosmic, but a local phenomenon. Hmm. And that's intriguing, because if you take that away, then the Big Bang model is in real trouble.
And it's in real trouble in so many ways, like the superstructures, like the walls and bubbles. They're finding structures made up of galaxies where we have the secular scientists from NASA and everywhere saying, you know what, gravity doesn't have enough time in 14 billion years to form all these strings and these superstructures of galaxies.
Yeah.
So that's another problem.
Well, they got lots of other problems too. The horizon problem, the flatness problem.
The horizon problem is like our problem of starlight and time.
Light travel, same sort of problem.
Same problem, but it's for the atheist. How could the whole universe get to the same background temperature in just this amount of time?
Look, Bob, the Big Bang model has been the standard model for more than 45 years. It's the only game in town, and that's a very unhealthy situation. And I like to point out to my students when I speak, I like to do a comparison of the Big Bang model of today of about 30 years ago. Mm. The expansion rate then was about 50 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Now it's about 80. Consequently, the age is different. Back then, they said it was 16 to 18 billion years. Now they say it's 13.71 plus or minus 1%. Those dates don't overlap. Back then, they didn't do dark matter. They didn't do dark energy. Mm. They didn't have inflation. Mm. In other words, the model today is nothing like the model 30 years ago. And yet, 30 years ago, they had complete confidence in the model. The one today, they have complete confidence in the model. A model that explains anything and everything explains nothing. It's plastic and can be moldable to explain no matter what comes along.
Wow. You mentioned the prediction of the Big Bang. I have looked up over the years criticisms of those who've said, well, the Big Bang made predictions of the distribution of chemical elements, of the temperature of the background microwave radiation. And I think it turns out when you look at those carefully that they fudged the numbers, modified it after the fact, like the CMB. If the universe was maybe 100 times bigger than it is, then they got the CMB right. But it's not 100 times bigger than it is. And the chemical elements, they totally fudged it after the fact.
Yeah, the COBE data from 91, it was announced, they were looking for the fluctuations they would expect in the Big Bang model due to early perturbations of material to give a structure in the universe. And it was off by a factor of 10, the fluctuations. What they did is they went back and they recalculated the model of the Big Bang to match the data, and then with a straight face claim that the data and the predictions exactly match, which is not true. I have a memory. I remember this.
Right. And how about, last thing, the supposed possible quantized redshifts, where some are saying it looks like by these huge inventories of galaxies, of tens of thousands of galaxies that have now been plotted in three dimensions, that they might be preferentially spaced from the Milky Way and from our solar system. Might that be true? Is there something to that?
I think so. It was first published over 35 years ago. It's been published more and more and more over the years. This case has gotten stronger. If taken at face value, it would seem to suggest that the universe has a bunch of concentric shells, and we're somewhere near the center of all those concentric shells, which is mind-blowing to anybody. But this is, by and large, ignored by astronomers and cosmologists because it makes
destroys
no
the
sense.
Big Bang.
It makes no sense in the Big Bang. So you just ignore it.
The Big Bang, there's no center of the universe. There are no boundaries. In the NAS, or the proceedings of, and I think it was the PNAS just a few years ago, published a paper with an alternative model to the Big Bang with the center and edges. So it's not like they've got it all wrapped up. The atheists know what's going on.
Yep.
Danny Faulkner, what an honor to have you on Real Science Friday. Thank you for your work. And January 1st, you got a new job, right?
Yep.
You're going to Answers in Genesis. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, that's exciting. Our website is Real Science Friday, realsciencefriday.com. Check out the store. Help us stay on the air.
You can support the ministry of Bob Enyart Live by subscribing to Bob's monthly Bible studies, monthly videos, monthly sermons, or monthly classic TV shows at kgovstore.com. You can also support the show and make a monthly or one-time donation by calling 1-800-8-ENYART or at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.